Let me welcome you to the last program on the agenda of the World Convention. This is a panel entitled Man on a White Horse. This was explained to me just recently. Apparently the idea is that people in general tend to be rather apathetic about politics, about society in general, and are waiting for someone on a white horse, the savior, to come along and save them from all the terrible things going on around them. And we're going to talk about politics and science fiction. You can see the members of our panel, all of whom are fairly well known. On my extreme left, John Brunner, Joe Patrizio, Mike Morgoth, John Campbell, and Rob Gindorf. And I'd like to ask Rob to start. Would you like to give us your idea, Rob, on the relationship between politics and science fiction?
Well, realizing that there is a majority of science fiction fans who don't see any connection between politics and science fiction, I'll go out on a limb, like you, and say that I do see a very close relationship. I would say it would depend on what definitions and what concepts you have of science fiction and of politics. Now, I happen to be one of those who think that science fiction is essentially, at the core, concerned with the possibilities of technically, and this means of course also socially, manipulating your environment. And this is what politics is, actually. So I think there's a relationship, and I wouldn't be surprised, or I had not expected before I became a fan, that fandom, as a body of science fiction enthusiasts, if they are, checked out, would be more interested in politics. I was let down, I'd say.
Would you like to comment on this?
One of the things that we have to recognize now, that was definitely not recognized in the days when I first started writing science fiction, is the magnitude of the economic problem of bringing to reality any of those ideas which were science fiction, such as space flight, nuclear energy. The original Manhattan Project, which first harnessed atomic power, represented an investment of $2 billion. The Gemini program is heading toward the moon. Space flight to the moon represents an investment of $20 billion. We have for some years talked about large numbers. We finally got a reasonably agreed on system of naming the large numbers. Mega is for a million, giga is for a billion. So the moon project is going to cost about 20 gigabucks. Now, in that space program that NASA has set up, one of the projects that they set up to investigate one specific item, a particular type of power plant for use in space, to develop about 10 kilowatts. This is more than you can practically do with the solar cells. Well, they were going to try to do it by having a solar boiler vaporizing a working fluid, running it through a turbine, recondensing it in a radiator, and so have a vapor power system. Because of the problem of getting rid of the heat at the exhaust end of the power turbine, they thought that something like potassium vapor would be the best thing to work with. The project had gone on for a couple of years, and something on the order of $250 million had been invested in that program, when some other research studies were made, and it has now been shown that steam, ordinary steam power plants, is in fact lighter effective than the potassium vapor power plant. This has not been welcomed by NASA. We have an article on this coming up in Analog. Now, the reason I mention is just that this one minor program for the development of a power plant for using spaceships on the moon, wherever, just a 10 kilowatt power plant for use in vacuum. NASA had already invested $250 million. To make this a little more understandable in real terms, the violent riots that took place in Los Angeles recently, 4 days of violence and destruction, square blocks of buildings burned out and looted. It is believed that the damage amounted to about $250 million. One slightly mistaken research project cost as much as the 4 days of vandalism and looting in Los Angeles. The magnitude of the projects necessary to bring one of these science fiction ideas into hardware reality is something we overlooked in the early days. In consequence, it is essential to recognize that politics, which is the organization of human groups into a functioning system, is just as fundamental to the development of future technology as the development of physical theories. The failure of social theory and of psychological theory to make possible the large-scale, smooth-working organizations that man must have is really much more dramatic than the occasional failure of one of our technical programs. Politics is a vital part of making the whole human race organism function. To ignore politics in science fiction is equivalent to ignoring the nervous system in a living organism.
Would you like to make another comment on the initial premise of the relationship between science fiction and politics before we move on to something specific?
I'm inclined to agree with John my feeling is that
I not hang the cards I hold in vain, because you will strike me low as a fire, brother. Come here to me, sir.
Struck. my feelings are that sciences such as psychology, economics, and so on, and politics are just as essential to. Jesus Christ. Sorry. Can you give me a different question? How about you, Joe? Do you want to say something? I would like to come in here, Mr. Chairman. One of the points that has just struck me while listening to John is the peculiar imbalance which is apparent in the example that he's adduced by, as he puts it, bringing down to real terms the consequences of a mistaken estimate in a power plant project for use in space. He brought this down to real terms by comparing it to the damage wreaked in Los Angeles in 4 days. Now, I don't know how long this particular power plant project was in hand, and I don't know how many people were directly involved in it over how great a length of time. But one can be fairly certain that because of the nature of the project, the people involved in it were among the best educated, best trained, and one would hope also the most socially aware and conscious of the people that we have to work with, of the entire human race. It seems to me anomalous and indeed terrifying that, owing to the nature of our present society, it is possible for an error in a research project involving hardware to be of comparable magnitude to the disaster in Los Angeles. I can only call it a disaster because of the suffering that is entrained. Whereas, we are leaving out of account the human suffering which cannot be measured in economic terms, the degree of misery and the degree of hatred running loose without a target to operate against, which must have led to this eventual boil-up. I think that here there is one of the clearest examples I have ever seen of the essential imbalance in our attitude towards our own society and our own human environment. To me, politics is perhaps a trifle more subjective than the definition which John gave, admirable though that is. He called it the organization of human beings into a functioning system. And this is true so far as it goes from the individual's point of view. But if you look at the total of that society, you realize that the nub of the matter is the exercise of power. Politics is the organization of the power exercised by one human being over another. It embraces virtually everything in our modern city society because no matter what aspect of life one looks at, one is involved in orders given by one person to another, whether directly or through intermediaries, whether the orders are given verbally or in writing, or whether they are given in the form of the exercise of economic power. And it is here, most importantly, that we as a civilization have failed. We are capable of deploying resources, both economic and mental, for terms of years, perhaps, in order to bring about a single costly error. In this country, our recent and most spectacular has been the cancellation of the TSR2 project. But if somebody wishes to research, analyze, study, and perhaps ameliorate the conditions in which people are living in slums, the conditions in which people are half-starving on sharecropped farms, or whatever one's particular local problem happens to be, he has to fight for years, bang on doors, scream at the top of his voice, and may very possibly go away discouraged. This is, as far as I'm concerned, the point at which science fiction and speculation and politics make their closest contact. It has been mentioned many times in the course of discussions at this convention that one of the important trends we are currently witnessing in the field is the movement away from the technological, as John mentioned, when he first came into the field, you were quite likely to have, he didn't say this in fact, but I turned one up in an anthology the other day, you were quite likely to have a crazy young brilliant scientist who had built himself a ship capable of going to Mars in his backyard. This kind of thing has been completely demolished by events. We are witnessing a trend away from this kind of rather glib assumption about the feasibility of something merely because the theory is nice and tidy. It is instanced by the trend towards deeper characterization in science fiction, more concern with the subjective reactions of the characters, and I think it is bringing us perhaps a little closer to what I would like to see, the analysis, the study, of the total interaction between the conscious and aware individual and the environment which he and people like him have created. We are turning loose an enormous surplus of psychic energy in this modern society of ours. The more leisure you give to somebody and the better you educate him, the more thinking power he's got available, the more he's got left over from the problems of everyday life, from food, drink, shelter and clothing. At present, we are funneling this off into a kind of economic sink. It's going into things like an expensive potassium vapor system that didn't work in the long run. We need, somehow, to absorb this into a comprehension, an understanding of the processes that operate upon human beings when they interact with each other as clear and precise as our understanding of mechanical forces which took Cooper and Conrad on their record-breaking flight.
Yes,
there are a couple of points there that I'd just like to not deny, but define a little more sharply. The question of power being that of one human being giving orders to another. How do you distinguish between the dictator and the prophet? Each of them says, tomorrow you will do thus. Is the prophet giving an order when he says that? The thing is, if a man who has means of perception, which may be anything from a telescope to a microscope to a radar device, reports a certain phenomenon and predicts its consequences, it will appear that he is giving orders to other men. Perhaps I can clarify this somewhat by making this point. I hold that I can never lose in an honest argument. Simply for this reason. What I am seeking in any argument is to determine what the truth is. If I'm wrong when I start, and the other fellow shows me that I am wrong, then I have gained. If I am right when I start, and the other fellow agrees with me, then I have gained confirmation. In an honest argument, each side is concerned with one and the same thing, determining the truth. In such a system, no one is giving orders to anyone. In such a system, each individual is trying to find what the truth is, what needs to be done, and who is in the best position to do it. This does not involve giving orders. However, in any group of living organisms, you know, this dear old bell-shaped curve, there's going to be a spread of abilities. Inevitably, there will be individuals who are incapable of recognizing a truth. The truth involved will be at a level beyond their abilities to perceive. Such individuals must be ordered. But such individuals inevitably will not recognize that it is necessary that they be ordered. One of the great problems of politics is finding some mechanism by which this problem can be handled. It's one problem that can never be solved. Now, in a beehive, the problem doesn't exist, wherefore it is solved. Every worker bee is happy its whole life long. It's doing exactly what it most wants to do. It's working itself to death in 6 weeks. And that's what it most wants to do. To make it unhappy, all you have to do is to confine it in a small box with all the food supply it needs. That is not happiness for the worker bee. Well, in a sufficiently homogeneous society, you wouldn't have the problem of ordering people. But it is not a question of men ordering men. It's more like the living body, where the eyes perceive facts of the outside world. The brain integrates and evaluates those facts. and passes along to the appropriate organs of the body commands, orders, or whatever you want to call them, that will preserve that organ. You know, the eye perceives that the hand is about to get run over by a passing truck, and the brain orders the hand, come away quick. This is an order. But it's the integration of perception, recognition, evaluation, and communication. To think of political power as being basically one man ordering another is a great oversimplification.
Could I come on this one second? You're suggesting then that it's feasible under the present circumstances to develop some kind of test to determine what each person is suited for, and they'll stay there for the rest of their life happily working away, is it?
Perhaps it would be better to say it is necessary to recognize that somehow we have to work out something that will do approximately that. There's an old story in Upper Peninsula, Michigan, about the old Finnish farmer up there who had just hired a new farmhand. And he was explaining to him, now we got to do that, and then we have to do that, and then after you get that, you have to do that. The farmhand looked at him and said, no, I can't do that. Farmer looks at him and says, you has to can. All right, this is the problem. You has to can.
Well, I should like to take up what seems to me rather a rash statement John made before that. He was referring to the fact that, as he puts it, in every system there were supposed to be people who were incapable of seeing a reality, seeing truth. Now, I should say that this is taken too much for granted. I agree with you all the way that this is true for our society and, I think, for all the societies we've had so far. But what makes you so convinced that we are bound to stick that way forever?
I did not say that this was characteristic of a society. I said it was characteristic of living organisms. The bell-shaped curve of distribution is the statistical distribution of characteristics that you will find in any system of living organisms where you do not have a very tight, a selective breeding mechanism. Now, in the beehive, you have established over some 600 million years of selective breeding, so tight a control that the bell-shaped curve is about like that.
Well, the bell-shaped curve is all right, it's the Gauss curve, but who is going to say that at both ends, or at one end of the bell-shaped curve, is bound to be ignorance? We are the ones who can set the standards, and the bell-shaped curve would or could turn out to have at the lower end a level of understanding which still is, sufficient to make people understand what's going on. It's not now, I agree with you, but who tells you that it won't ever be?
The bell-shaped curve is characteristic of any measurable quality of any system of living organisms. Now, we don't determine who is ignorant. It is not a question of man against man. It's a question of man against the universe. The universe has determined that we are ignorant. We are too ignorant to build a faster-than-light space drive. This is not something that was determined by man. Einstein did not say, you guys are too dumb to build a faster-than-light space drive. What he said was, there is a law in the universe of this nature. It is not important what one human being thinks of another. What is important is what happens in the universe. That's why I am not particularly sold on theories. I think they're fine. I think they're useful tools. made the comment in an editorial a while back that every engineering technique that ever worked will work today. It may not be economically practical now, but it will work. A flint axe will still cut down trees. Agreed, this is not what you would equip a lumberjack with when you were setting out to do some foresting. But it will work. The universe, not man and his societies, determines what's stupid, what's ignorant, what is nonsense. It's on this basis that science fiction must approach the problem, not on the basis of human theories. Every theory that man has ever developed, without exception, has, sooner or later, proven to be inaccurate or wrong. You've got to go on the pragmatic test of, does it work? And that's the basis on which I'm talking in discussing the bell-shaped curve in politics.
Well, we're doing that comment because I think Joe has something to say.
Joe wants to make a
comment. Well, just going to go a bit further on that point about people being incapable of accepting a truth, I think you said. This, of course, brings us up with the statement, what is a truth? And surely, science fiction has come up with a lot of good stories about people who will not accept what is currently thought as a truth. And where are you going to draw the line between what is a truth and what is currently thought as a truth? I mean, it's not an easy point. I don't expect an answer. But it is the sort of thing which is discussed in science fiction. And I'm not quite sure what this has to do with the politics in science fiction, though.
In essence, you're asking the question, how shall we know the truth?
Yes. And
right.
And if one person or one group of people have decided what the truth is and make everybody accept this as the truth, we surely come up with a 1984 situation.
The essential answer to that is, it's the same problem that Galileo ran into.
Yes.
It recurs repeatedly. It always will come up, whether it's in politics or anything else. How shall we know the truth? The truth shall set ye free. Fine, go find it. Okay, and the only answer that you can rely on is the one I just mentioned. Does it work? Incidentally, I wonder how many of you here have ever read Kipling's little poem, Tomlinson. It's a lovely little poem. Basically, and quite inadequately, it concerns one Tomlinson who died and headed for the pearly gates. And when he got to the gates, St. Peter asked, what have you done? And Tomlinson explained that he had read this and he thought about that and he had considered that. And Peter said, yes, but what have you done? Well, I also considered doing that, and I read somewhere that such and such, and, but what have you done? It wound up with Peter saying, look, we don't have any time for you. You're holding up the line. Go to the other place. At which he was rejected, too, because he hadn't done anything worthy of getting in and consuming Satan's valuable coal. The only test is, what have you done? What does it work? That is the only test. Any other test is one man testing another man. But when you ask, does it work? It's one man testing the universe.
Fallacious.
Somebody says fallacious. What's your point on that?
A society can be envisaged, has been envisaged, where slavery, all the corruption, all the evil you can imagine, goes on, all the things that we don't like to talk about, goes on. And it would work perfectly according to your definition.
Well, it does, doesn't it?
It does work. Slavery is a good and useful system. And that is something that our current political
philosophy holds is always evil, always wicked, never works, is a horrible oppression, and that just happens not to be true. It is not always evil. It is not always destructive. As a matter of fact, one of the definitions you will get, if you ask somebody what is slavery, one of the most common definitions you get is, well, a slave is somebody who is forced to labor at chores not of his own choosing, against his will, under threat of physical punishment if he doesn't do it, and if he tries to escape, he'll be arrested and brought back to his master. It's a quite common definition of slavery. And this is the perfect definition of the position of the child. He is forced... Yes?
The position of every soldier in every democratic army who is conscripted to fight the very thing he is conscripted for.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Now, one other point here. It has been held that the slavery system in the South in the United States was a horrible, vicious, terrible, wicked, awful thing. We are so removed in time and cultural orientation from that period that it's almost impossible for us to recognize the realities of that time. One of the important realities of that time, which we can observe simply through here the written facts of history, at the time all the white men had gone away to fight the North off, the Negro slaves were laboring on the plantations back home to support them. There was not one Negro rebellion.
That's true.
It is also necessary to recognize that when Tsar Alexander II of Russia issued an imperial edict freeing the serfs rebelled. The noble lords did not. In Ethiopia, in 1919, because Ethiopia wanted to join the League of Nations, the government issued an imperial edict freeing the slaves. There was an immediate slave rebellion. They were forced to rescind that edict and issue a new one, saying that no master could free his slave without the slave's consent. There are many factors of slavery that we have been given such a heavily propagandized viewpoint on that we don't know the full story. Look, I can make a statement which is perfectly true. And what I'm going to tell you is the truth and nothing but the truth. I found a very convenient way to get from my home to New York. I go downtown, down to my local suburb, and in the town there, I rise about 2 feet off the ground and go on into New York without touching down again until I get there. Now, this is a perfectly true statement. I've just left out one slight factor. There's a train under me. Well, the deadliest lie there is a half-truth. John Brunner has something.
It almost hurts me to have to say so, but I think these statements we've been hearing about slavery, although they have a nice, tidy, symmetrical pattern about them, bear about as much relation to the true situation as the word bang does to an explosion in a dynamite factory. It is all very well to say that in certain circumstances, a slave society can exist and be efficient. It is also perfectly true that a method of transport which involves exterminating your horses, like the high-express, high-speed stagecoach system, is a workable and efficient one, but it is hellish wasteful of horses. Any society which is sufficiently disregardful of its human resources to use slavery is a society which is absurdly and ridiculously inefficient. And it is not by any means sufficient to say, does it work? What you have got to say is, does it work as well as we can possibly make it work? This is the essential criterion. I've filled a whole sheet with points that I want to pick up from what's being said earlier on. So I'm going to have to make a short selection from them. There are so many things here that I think are superficially attractive and essentially fallacious. To begin with, I'll go right the way back to what John Campbell was saying about a comparison between a dictator and a prophet. As he just said, there is nothing so dangerous as a half-truth, and the half of the truth that has been left out of this particular question is that there exists such a thing as a self-fulfilling prophecy. And this is neither an order nor a true prophecy. This is something which is so characteristic of the relationship of one man with another that I can think of dozens of examples, but I'll select one which particularly applies to the next stage of the argument insofar as it's an argument and not just a tossing out of random opinions that we've been through so far. You has to can. Let us envisage a country at war. I would go out on a limb and say a revolutionary society, which is the example par excellence of a group of human beings organized by common agreement towards a common end. But because most of the people here have no direct experience of a revolutionary society, I'll take the example which is fresh in my own mind from childhood memories, and I imagine is fresh to most people here, that of a country at war, where, for example, you might have two men receiving the same messages from their superiors in whatever hierarchy of instruction is currently operating. One is a pacifist. He regards these as orders, and not merely orders, but intolerable entrenchments upon his personal freedom. The other is a man who is happy with the society in which he has been born and raised, and accepts these as information useful to him in his personal attempt to defend this society. It seems to me that if you are going to have any workable, viable, and self-perpetuating kind of society at all, you have got to have a society which accepts and permits both these extremes. You have got, in particular, to create within your society a channel whereby a new idea is thoroughly examined and tested rather than rejected a priori. What is currently wrong with Now, one of the things that is currently wrong with our society is that this channel does not exist, that we are capable of making verifiable speculations as regards the universe around us. In other words, we are very good at applying John Campbell's test, does it work when it comes to mechanical things? We are extraordinarily bad at applying either this inferior test or the ultimate test, does it work as well as we can possibly make it, to the interaction of one human being upon another. We are, in fact, how should I put it? We are so obsessed with our own achievements that we are looking only to the self-congratulatory aspect of our technological successes, we are leaving out the things which these technological successes in themselves do to human beings. What I want to know, and what nobody either here or in many, many previous discussions of the subject has been able to tell me, is this. Why does one have to stick to this comparison, which John has been drawing on rather freely, of the living organism and the hormone and nerve-borne messages which communicate between the various parts? A human being is in himself a total organism. We ought to be summing over a group of total organisms. We are, in fact, stumbling around in enumeration when we ought to be looking for the transfinite. If anybody's not familiar with Cantorian mathematics, I'll give him a short rundown later if I can. But what it comes down to, as far as I can see, is this. We have been attempting to apply to human beings, which are highly complex and unpredictable organisms, things that even on the physical level are only applicable macroscopically. We are already aware that once you get down to nuclear level, your standard precepts about trajectory, mass, and measurability of position go by the board. I should have thought that this would be an intuitive assumption by anybody who has ever opened his eyes to the way in which human beings do not react in predictable fashion. What I want to see, and what I would like to see political science fiction dealing with, is not an analysis and a re-examination of the various kinds of human society that we have had, but an attempt to get rid of the bell-shaped curve. To say that merely because every human society up till now has contained this particular admixture does not mean that it is a dominant factor. We are summing over a group of total organisms, to wit, human beings. We are not summing over lumps of mud, blocks. We are not summing over identical machines on the production line of a factory. If we can make this breakthrough, then I think we are going to have some political science fiction which is as good as any science fiction that has ever been published anywhere.
I went on rather.
Sorry. You're thinking, in fact, that it would be possible today to write virtually a utopian novel, then?
No, I think the utopia has this essential drawback, that it is one man's standpoint at one period of time. The thing which makes me fundamentally disagree with, for example, your orthodox Marxist, is that although he is working with a set of truths where he can point to examples where this has worked, he is looking at it from an obsolete standpoint. I was once talking with Arthur Clarke in the Globe. We were talking about the possibility of writing an honest novel about the year 2000. We came to the conclusion that you need to spend 2 years in solid research before you dare put a word on paper. It would take you 6 months to write, and in those 6 months you would be overtaken by events. Now, I do not think that a utopia is either necessary or possible at this juncture.
John, you made one proposition that you thought that we should get rid of the bell-shaped curve. Now, how do you propose to do that?
This was a rather superficial statement of what is in my mind, in fact. Thank you for picking me up on it. The bell-shaped curve, the normal distribution, when applied to a human population, fits the existing state of affairs. It fits, for example, the distribution of IQ, by and large. But it does not fit such standard and almost now second-hand science fiction concepts as, say, total tectogenetic manipulation. And this was what was in the back of my mind in saying get rid of the bell-shaped curve in front of a science fiction audience. In front of any other kind of audience, I wouldn't put it quite like that.
Of course, Hitler was trying to get rid of that bell-shaped curve in his own way. The difficulty is, as you said, what we should do is to build the best system we possibly can. Now, I can give you one of the fundamental laws of universal ethics. This is a fundamental law of ethics that is applicable anywhere at any time. It is unethical to demand of any entity that it do that which is impossible for that entity. I think anyone will agree that that is a fundamental of ethics. Inasmuch as we are not perfect, we cannot invent and cannot operate a perfect system. Now, I will agree with you in full, in particular, on what you said about the difference between the nuclear performance and the macrocosmic performance. The human being, like the individual nucleus, is indefinable. The society is a macrocosm and can be defined, but only in statistical terms. That is our essential problem. And that's why that any society will have the bell-shaped curve, which is a statistical thing.
Gentleman down in the audience had a question.
This statistical curve.
I'd like to tie what's just been said back to the point where we started, the question of the nail on the white horse. the possibilities of any of dictatorship. We are getting today a larger and larger amount of dictatorship. The reason is that more and more people are faced with situations which they do not wish to be responsible for, so they're always looking for somebody to turn over situation to. Now, this is where the science fiction element comes in. People have a certain tolerance for rate of change. You know, they will tolerate a certain speed as they're driving along in a car. If that speed is exceeded by no matter how small a fraction, they will start to panic. Now, in terms of information today, the rate of change is fantastic. The rate of change which any given generation has to undergo is fantastic compared to what it was only a few generations ago. Right. Therefore, the temptation to hand over all this lot to some dictator who will give them a framework within which they can operate is also tremendous. Whether the framework is a rational one doesn't matter. I once spent a long time, trying to read the Book of the Saints, the Mormon book. I couldn't get anywhere with it. But the Mormons, I understand, have a very sound organization and body and function quite well as far as people inside them are concerned. Right. So we are in danger of dictatorships caused by the fact that we have this flood of information which is exceeding people's speed of perception. Now, there's also another factor that's linked with economic life. In the old days, I think the majority of people did not think as individuals, they thought as members of a given class. They were conditioned to behave as Englishmen, lower class people, middle class people, whatever. As they get greater economic freedom, more means, their power of choice is extended. What is freedom? There's no such thing as freedom in the abstract. It's power of choice. I can do this or I can do that. If I can do this, that, or that, my freedom is extended. Now, they have a much greater freedom to believe, you know, of mental choice. But this is, again, difficult for people who are conditioned only to believe in as members of a class. You can say, you can be lower class, you can be middle class, you can be aristocratic, you can be what you like. Think of the responsibility that's put on the poor person who's ever been trained to accept that. And if I can just get a point in passing on this, I think this is very important in science fiction nowadays. This trend towards the subjective is due to the fact that people who never before even knew they existed suddenly find they exist, and they find themselves reacting against the old regime which was set, you know, in terms of the class. Anyway, I don't want to go off onto that. What I do want to get onto is this. I think that one of the things that science fiction can do to help people is to produce dramatizations, you know, fiction, novels, which are acceptable to people and which help to dramatize the situation of more and more information coming in. It's important to understand that the people who are of a rather fixed mentality are more easily approached by a dramatization of a subject than by a textbook on the subject. You know, it's an old slogan, don't tell and show, you know, so you put on a show. Okay, now, how can science fiction help to avoid dictatorship? It can help to avoid dictatorship by, through the media of its stories, accustoming people to a wider rate of change so they can accept an idea without getting into a panic.
Do you want to comment?
Well, yes, I very much agree with what has been said from the audience there. One point that struck me when this title of this panel was mentioned by Ethel to me, Man on the White Horse, was the idea that somebody seems to think that people are bound forever to look up for someone on a white horse to solve their troubles, which I think is just not true. It just hasn't been tried so far to make people free of this need, this emotional need, I think, for somebody to tell them. And that's where another argument fits in that John Campbell has been using. You've been saying that the slaves were terrified when they were freed, which is quite true, but you've not gone on to say why they were terrified. Well, they just couldn't be helped to be terrified because nobody ever set them free to realize that they could lead another life than just be slaves.
Some slaves joined the Union Army, didn't they?
May I point out that the slaves really had a very sound reason for wanting to remain slaves. In your textbooks, you will find it said that the serf was bound to the land. He could not leave the land. This is one way of expressing it, but you've got to consider it in an Einsteinian universe. There's relativity. The other way of stating it was that his land could not be taken away from him. The serf saw serfdom as having as its primary characteristic the one most interesting to him, that his land could not be taken away. Now, as you know, the basic crying urge, the deep motivation of the peasant throughout the world, throughout the years of history, has been the desire to have a piece of land. But what the serf did not want in Russia was to have his land taken away from him. And that's what freedom of freeing the serfs meant. He would no longer be protected in having land. Another thing, one of the things that comes up in actual functioning slavery is that the slave has cradle to grave security. He is a valuable piece of property. His master takes care of him. Of course, there are always damn fool masters. There always have been people who will beat a good horse to death. That's always happened. But it's also true that no human system has ever yet been evolved that didn't quite commonly make mistakes. They execute the wrong man. The doctor gives the guy the wrong medicine. There's always mistakes. Now, if you're looking for a perfect system in which no one will ever be mistreated, will ever be a victim of injustice, well, maybe the great dictator, God Almighty, can produce such a system. We must do the best we possibly can, and that's short of perfection. Stop looking for perfection and try for an optimum. Now, here's a little question worth considering. What is the fastest way for a human being to get from London to New York? Well, that's a tough one. If we make it how to get from London to Manchester. The answer to that is walk. It takes a quarter of a million years to invent airplanes. And don't forget that. I'm not being facetious on that. What? No, I said a man. If I had said an amoeba, it would be true. This is not just facetious. Don't expect, don't hold it against the Sumerians that they didn't do an adequate job on public health. They didn't know about it. There are lots of mistakes we are making today with the highest idealism. You know, George Washington died because his physicians bled him three times in 3 days while forbidding him any water to drink. In essence, he died of dehydration and anemia. They were doing the best they knew how. Would you hold them guilty of murder? Another thing, you all know the parable of the Good Samaritan. Do you consider that little story was true?
Yes.
Oh, there's very little chance that it was a statement of true events. The essence of the thing is that it communicated the truth. The job of science fiction, as I see it, is very much the same. We do not tell histories of true events. We tell parables. We do have an opportunity to examine the possibilities of other social systems. That is a proper job of science fiction.
Yes, Ted.
There are no other
social systems and the one we have and have had since the beginning of history. A lot of us are talking about slavery, which is still existent today in our own culture, describing how it's made. My own terms of reference, take a person, say you're going to do as I tell you, or brother, I'm going to kill you, and you've got a conscript soldier. I don't know how necessary it is for any culture to have conscript soldiers, but I do know no culture has managed without that or slavery. We're very good with slavery, but we've still got it. So we get the point of people being all idealistic. I'm not seeing the mother in books. I think the gentleman on the extreme left, I can't remember his name, made a very good point when he said, we look at this bell-shaped curve and instinctively we say, the top is the cream. The top can also be the scum. How about the bottom layer a chance to live in their own way, gentlemen?
You left out two other classes beside the conscript soldier. There's also the criminal and the insane.
No, sir, I disagree emphatically. A criminal is paying the tariff for an act of which he knows the tariff before he commits it. No one who is a conscript soldier, in my experience, has had any opportunity whatsoever to decide whether or not his country will go to war.
What I have in mind is, you know this old business, the man has a right to his own opinion. It's very difficult to get any agreement on just what that means. I suggest the answer is, a man has a right to any opinion, whatever, that he will and can pay for.
Yes. A man then who has the right, as a slave or a fool, has a right to refuse to obey the overseer, is in a sense killing himself, which is hardly the act of any sane orgasm.
There have been great many discussions of political rights, and American Declaration of Independence, which was one of the great propaganda documents of all time, starts off talking about certain inalienable rights granted to them by the Creator, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, it is obvious that an inalienable right does not have to be defended. If it's inalienable, nobody can take it away from you, so you don't have to defend it. And therefore, it is obvious that life is not an inalienable right. So far as I've been able to figure out, there is one and only one truly inalienable right. It can be surrendered, but it cannot be taken from you. That's the right to try. Nobody can take from you the right to try, though you can surrender it. I think one of the best examples of that was an American Jewess who had been trapped in one of the Nazi death camps. And she and a line of other Jews was being marched into the extermination chambers when she turned on one of the Nazi guards, blinded him, and succeeded in clawing his throat out. She did a fairly good job of ruining the next Nazi guard that came after her. You know what they did for her? To her for that? They killed her. She had not surrendered her right to try. The others had. We have the right to try, which can't be taken away from us. Now it's on that basis that you can say a man has a right to any opinion, whatever, provided he can and will pay for it. You know, there's the story about the guy who jumped off the top of the Empire State Building. As he fell past the 34th floor, he shouted to his friend in the window, "See, I told you it wouldn't hurt."
Well, I just want to make the point that we have advanced so far that we can indeed strip a man from the right, from the possibility to try. It has been done, you know. Not only in China, but elsewhere. A man can be conditioned to the extent that he just is made unable to exercise this right to try, and that seems to have been overlooked.
He has been induced to surrender.
Ha 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 ha
Once again, I've filled nearly a page with things that I feel ought to be picked up and given a second look. The nub of the point which John was making about damn fool masters in a slave-owning society who will ruin their valuable property resolves back into the ultimate analysis to the truism that the only worthwhile government is government by men of goodwill. It was pointed out by Donald Michael, an American psychologist, that under our present Western system, anybody who offers himself for office thereby automatically disqualifies himself because the people who crave power are those least fitted to wield it. But the slave-owning societies and serf and villain-owning societies that I know anything about have institutionalized the exercise of power into an unquestioned right on the part of a small element of their society. And I think that there have been some rather gross generalizations made on this. I know rather less about the serf-owning society of Tsarist Russia than I do about the villain-owning society of medieval England. It assorts rather badly with the assumption that the dearest wish of a villain, in this strict sense, a villain's family, was to stay on the productive land with which they've been associated since birth. It assorts rather ill with that, that one of the proudest and most jealously guarded privileges of a medieval town was that of granting sanctuary to runaways from this system, who, provided they could establish residence for 1 year and 1 day within the town boundary, were thereby automatically freed from their previous villainage. The nature of a slave society, too, is one which ought to be examined a little more closely than has been done so far. It is not sufficient to say a slave-owning society, because there are various types. That of the southern United States was inherently unstable and would have broken apart, I think, had there not been a civil war. Its fundamental flaw, as compared with, say, the Roman slave-owning system, which lasted for a very considerably longer time, or the classical Greek slave-owning system, was that the slave was property absolute, and this is something that you cannot do to a human being. In Roman and Greek law, a slave had a certain inalienable minimum of possessions, which could not be taken away from him even by his master. There were also limits fixed upon the degree to which a master could punish a slave. This was not the case in the southern United States. A slave was property absolute. And if you've ever read the advertisements for runaway slaves in the papers of the Deep South, you will see that almost invariably the slaves which have run away are described as being mutilated, cropped of one ear, nose slit, blind in one eye, scarred with whippings, and so forth. They, in John Campbell's definition, apparently retained the right to try, and some of them got away with it. But the question of cradle-to-grave security takes on an entirely new light if you look at it like this. The right to die on the same patch of land where you were born is that of a territorial animal, one that, like a lion marking its hunting ground, or a sparrow chasing away intruders in the vicinity of its nest, is reacting blindly in response to a territorial instinct. If human beings have not got the seeds of more than this within them, then they are not fit to be masters of this planet. And I'm going to throw two more out. I'm not myself a practicing Christian, but since Christian references have been made here, I'm going to shoot back a couple of them. The parable of the Good Samaritan has a point which not very many people know about. There are probably people here who have read Lucius Epuleius' The Golden Ass. If you've read the Penguin Classics edition, the translation by Robert Graves, you will recall that in his scholarly and erudite introduction, Graves pointed out that in many of the mystery cults which were common under the Roman Empire, bad luck was regarded as contagious. And in fact, a friend of the narrator of The Golden Ass tells the story of how bad luck was brought upon his house by his befriending and helping a man he found by the roadside, an old friend who was down on his luck, because a curse had been cast on him. And the witches who had cast the curse came into the friend's house that night, and he reaped the reward of helping somebody who had a fate upon him, a guess. The point of the parable of the Good Samaritan is that it is a counterblast to this kind of mystery cult teaching, which was very prevalent in Palestine at the time of the Roman occupation. Christianity was, in fact, in this sense, a revolutionary concept. It was attempting to get away from the notion that human beings could be cursed and thereby made contagiously the bearers of ill luck. It was attempting to reintegrate into a functioning unit those individuals who offered themselves as human material. And in fact, probably the most successful secret society in history was the early Christian Church. Which brings me on to a slight flaw in John Campbell's incontestable ethical law. He said that it is unethical to demand of any organism that it shall do the impossible. In the most widely accepted system of ethical beliefs prevalent in the Western world today, the prime injunction of Jesus Christ is, be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect.
I just wanted to raise one point very briefly. You mentioned about the territoriality proposition. Well, how do you distinguish between the serf's territoriality and that of his master, the Duke, who is also defending his territory?
In fact, I think that man is a territorial animal in the biological sense, but has this unique faculty that he can abstract from the actual physical patch of ground which an animal is compelled to accept to a self-defined, if he is very lucky, self-designed abstract pattern equivalent thereto, if you like, a mental map of it. In this sense, you will find that a man can be happy with without a home, even though a home is the typical territorial equivalent in modern Western society, provided that he has something created by himself, which he recognizes as a psychological equivalent thereto. His work, for example, this is quite often observed among people who have a very intensive creative bent, I think. They will frequently disregard the appurtenances, the belongings, which most of us require in order to feel comfortable, in order to feel that the world is not essentially hostile towards us. They can set up their own abstracted versions of this. Possibly the most spectacular example of all would be in the case of a wandering saint like Vinoba Bhave or of Gandhi, whose worldly possessions were supposed to be so light that one man could lift them.
Do you hold that true of every human being?
No, I will not make any kind of generalization about every human being who has ever been raised. I will only make generalizations about the animal, the biological aspects of a human being, about the psychological aspects. We don't know nearly enough to make sweeping generalizations.
I am actually asking that we recognize a broader spectrum in the term human being. Now, those things which you have stated are true of yourself. They are true of me. Mac Reynolds is a perfect example of the type of human being who can be at home where he is. But this is not true of all men, and it is an absolute and intolerable, dictatorial and arbitrary imposition to hold that all men should have that characteristic.
I know.
Because any effort to make all men identical, to compress all mankind, that bell-shaped curve, into one. That's what Hitler was trying to do.
Would you say that it would be impossible, as well as not desirable, to make all mankind identical in that they are brought to believe that reason is the prime criterion for their actions? Would you call this unethical or impossible, or both?
Because it's impossible, it is unethical.
Well, that's a definition of possibility which I can't subscribe to, I'm afraid. But I wonder what my fellow panelists will have to say on this.
Well, it's not the point. I thought the point you're trying to make, that no system should impose the that no system should try to make everybody the same, to compress your bell curve. Surely this is what politics is trying to do all the time, every system.
of politics is attempting to do this. Every system of politics, yes, surely it's not a good thing. I'm not trying to say that it is a good thing, but this is what it's trying to do. And to go back a bit, point made from the floor and by Mr. Campbell was that science fiction's position here should be to disseminate information so that this can be done.
The requirement can be done. What's the reference?
Well, the dissemination of information so that people will think along given lines. You'd seem to be, to me, saying that science fiction was a good propaganda agency. The speaker from the floor seemed to think it was something along the same lines, but anti-propaganda in a way, if you see what I mean.
I am consistently opposed to any one-sided discussion. I have taken the side of slavery here this afternoon, primarily because I doubt that any place in the general public domain can you find a discussion of why slavery was used. Human beings are not utter fools. They do not consistently practice something that is utter folly. Now, you get only one side of the story. If this were a society dedicated entirely to slavery, I can assure you I would be arguing violently against slavery.
You'd be a slave.
I'm afraid not, for long. One way or another, I'm too much of a barbarian. Have you ever stopped to think why it was the American colonists went to all the trouble of importing slaves from Africa when they had all those red men running around in the woods? It was impossible to enslave an Indian. They never could. My Scots ancestors were remarkably like the American Indians. Nobody ever succeeded in enslaving them either.
There's a question from the floor over here first, if you don't mind.
No longer relevant,
right. You, sir.
If I might take up on this territorial idea of the human race, I think it's very fair, and taking from John Brunner's argument that, in fact, a great many of us can sort of gather something around us which places a territory, that we become something like a snail in a sense, carrying a sort of private house of our own, that it's a house we live in, or a few possessions, or a few books, or whatever it may be, that gives us our little bit of ground. And I think John Campbell was saying that you couldn't expect everyone to be that, we shouldn't build a society on everyone being like that. But surely I would have thought we shouldn't have a society, as it has been in a great many times, which was dead against that development, which was all in favour of tying a man to a bit of ground. It should always have allowed the possibility of the other thing, or I think a bit more than that, to have rather encouraged the possibility. In fact, we want a society, I would have thought, always, which has established facilities to destroy itself. Seeing to its own destruction, encouraged so that things may change.
John? While the gentleman from the floor was talking just then, something hit me. Gently. I was reminded suddenly of a question which occurred to me when reading one of John Campbell's editorials on the barbarian. And it ties up rather closely to the question of the true measure of the efficiency of a society. Now, a friend from the floor was just saying that it would be a bad thing to have a society that was dead set against the idea of people abstracting their territoriality, to coin a really horrible phrase. In other words, refusing to sit down on a chunk of land or in a nice little suburban semi-detached house or what have you. I think it is a bad thing because anything which diminishes the range of human resources available for exploitation in any given crisis that the society may meet is a bad thing. Paradoxically, however, the efficient society, in the sense that it goes out and takes over large chunks of other people's territory, is not a society which is tolerant, not a society which is exploiting the widest possible range of its human material. You will notice that a conquering society is vigorous and expansive, a decadent society sits at home and enjoys it. A decadent society faced with an expansive barbarian society is liable to fall to pieces. But one is not to say from this that your Mongol on horseback, rolling out the map of Europe in front of him, is a superior human being, insofar as one can apply standards of civilization, to the people he is treading on. What we are desperately in need of is a decadent society in the sense that it is tolerant of a very wide range of deviations from a standard norm and capable of exploiting them, because they add to the variety of the human resources within the society, one which has achieved this to such a degree that instead of merely passively accepting the competition of expansive societies on its borderlands and quietly putting up with the intrusion of it because it is seeing this as yet another variation on the human theme, but will be able to accept whole exterior societies into itself. I think that there is a plot here, and I will hand it to anybody who cares to do a nice galactic empire novel in the next few months. By then, I might get around to it myself.
There's one thing interesting. That's a remarkable statement for an Englishman with the background of England's great dynamic growth on this planet. You are saying that the period between Elizabeth I and Victoria was a period of English decadence. It was during this period that England went out to the societies around the world and reacted in a very dynamic and adaptive manner. When the English came to America and encountered the Red Indians, they reacted with, in effect, an extermination warfare. When they encountered the Maori in New Zealand, there was a brief period of sort of establishing the pecking order, whereupon they settled down to a joint society. When they encountered the Negroes in Africa, they set up a slavery system. This was the period during which England exported more ideas and more basic concepts of industrial civilization than any other nation in the world's history. This you call a decadent period.
I'm sorry, no. In the sense of the argument, which I've not yet fully developed even in my own mind, we are now in the decadent period.
We're no longer exporting.
No, the question is not that of exporting. Preferably, often, more often than not, forcibly. After all, we didn't take into account very much the feelings of the Hindus in India as to whether they wanted to acquire an Oxford education grounding in Virgil. The exportation of ideas in this sense is a barbarian characteristic if it is done forcibly. We are, in a sense, moving into a decadent stage. We are beginning to recognize the essential non-viability of the barbarians' proud appurtenances like missiles and H-bombs. We are beginning to recognize the fact that to exploit the maximum range of human talent, a society must be tolerant to the degree where it is willing to gamble its own dissolution against a less tolerant society, in order to increase its variety and its adaptability. In the most concrete example that I can think of,
which is one which I have often used in CND,